Welcome to episode one of the brand new podcast dedicated to The Expanse and rewatching it or watching it for the first time. If you want to get in on the action before season four, This Is America, drops on Amazon Prime in December. Welcome to A Legitimate Salvage. Hi, everybody. We are your panel, a panel of Doctor Who fans who like shows that have a little more hard SF to them. Although, could there possibly be a show that's more hard SF-y than Doctor Who? I don't know. Let's go around the table and introduce ourselves. We are your hosts for A Legitimate Salvage.
I'm Jen Burt.
I'm Katie Burt.
Warren Fry. And I am Chip Sudderth, and yeah, we're Doctor Who nerds, so of course we're totally talking about The Expanse. Why in the world are we doing this?
A show that has very little to do with Doctor Who in terms of tone or anything else, really.
Not even that many crossover talent.
What is it about The Expanse that trips or triggers here?
I think you said it already. It's hard SF, which there's like a mandated lack thereof on TV. There's only one hard SF show per television era, and this happens to be the one this time. Although, I guess with Netflix, that might be a little different, but...
Yeah, I think basically since Battlestar Galactica went off the air, there was like... I'm sure there were shows that tried, but this feels like the only one that's really filled that niche.
This is the worthy successor, although it's very different than Battlestar Galactica, I think.
One of the things that draws me to it is the world building and the politics seem much more expansive than Battlestar Galactica.
Expansive, did you say?
Yes. The first of many of the very same
I was just about to say, yeah. It's not,
sure
that's going to happen again.
You know, for me, I feel like I don't actually think of myself necessarily as like a hard science fiction fan. And rewatching these first two episodes, that point was hammered home for me, which is interesting. But yeah, for me, it feels like, yeah, like hard politics or hard sociopolitics. Like that's the thing that I like best about it. You know, people compare it to Game of Thrones, and I do think that there's something there in terms of the early seasons, but I think it does a lot of those personal and political ripples of, you know, alliances and allegiances and tribalism really, really well, like better than Game of Thrones ever did. So that's one of the many reasons why I love The Expanse.
One of the things I like about sci-fi in book form is that they have the real estate to actually think things through and say, if this happened, what would happen there? And, you know, and sort of expand on, like you said, the world building. So with TV, usually it's just one premise and a few bits and pieces here and there, but this one, and it's got books to fall on to take the world building from, but they really go for it. You know, they actually go, just as one example, I remember watching it, maybe season two, I finally realized, oh wait, there's not that many actual white people in this. And that makes complete sense, because 200 years from now, there wouldn't be as many straight up white people, because people travel all over the place, and presumably more as time goes on. But just stuff, little things like that, not little thing, but you know, subtle things, I guess is a better way to put it, like that.
Yeah, it's like the show is almost easily diverse, as far as I can tell. And I'm sure it falls down here and there, but the characters are kind of rich. And I think the characters are the link for me for The Expanse that make me sort of get into it. There are a lot of them, and it took me forever to actually get their names straight. As I was watching it, and as I was taking note of all the world building and stuff like that, I was also taking note of how these characters interact with that world building. It's not just some sort of artificial, you know, the realm of fire over here, the realm of air over here, and it's just sort of like reading an encyclopedia or watching an encyclopedia. These characters are all part of this world, and it interacts with them, and they have to cope with it.
Yeah, the world has an internal logic that even if you're not aware on even like the most specific level of like what that visual effect means or what that production design choice means, I feel like it comes through in the final product. You can tell that there's an organization and logic to the world that works, especially from like storyline to storyline, which I think is really important when they can feel so separate from one another, especially early on in the show.
Let me jump in a little further and demonstrate my ignorance. I'm not a big Game of Thrones fan.
Me either, Chip.
I haven't experienced much of it. So what I have gathered about the show from osmosis is that it can be pretty darn nihilistic, and it's not a good, and people with like senses of honor and internal moral conflict aren't long for that world. That's the wrap on it. So when I hear The Expanse described as Game of Thrones in outer space, I'm not sure that rings true for me because of the characters.
Yeah, I think the thing that for me is the most similar about the two stories is that there are those like parallel stories that are happening. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain buy-in you have to like commit to or make as a viewer where they're not necessarily going to cross over. You're not going to understand how they're related. But I agree, like there is a nihilism, and that's one of the reasons why I think Game of Thrones, while I enjoy it in a lot of ways, was never one of my favorite shows. I think another thing that The Expanse does differently is it has those parallel storylines, but as you were talking about in terms like the diversity, Game of Thrones follows mostly just like the ruling families of this world. Like mm-hmm. there's a little bit of like, ugh, like some characters who are less important or have less power, but for the most part, it's, you know, these families who are squabbling over power and actually have like some quote unquote like legitimate claim to it. And like The Expanse just feels so much more expansive in whose story they try to tell. You know, it's not just people in power. It's, you know, mostly totally different people. Well,
it's not just, oh, these are the characters from Earth. Like we see mm-hmm. three main characters from Earth, right? In this first episode, they all have very different experiences, even though two of them are white guys. Like they're all coming. I mean, it takes a while for you to learn that those, but like all of their decision making going forward, it's not, oh, we're just doing this because we're from Earth or we're from Mars or like you were saying, we're from a ruling family. That it's all based on the payoff of really watching. One of the things I love about this show is rewatching it is like seeing what's set up early on. There's mm-hmm. layers yeah. of it that's what I love in a television show is being able to go back and see all of these different things.
That's yeah. the thing I'm most excited about yeah. doing this rewatch is all the stuff that I missed and all the stuff that is important. It's a big, complicated story. And if you're new to The Expanse and if you're watching this for the first time alongside us, it's not like you got to keep notes, but...
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
Plus, you're sort of thrown in the deep end right at the top because the first season is more or less belt-centric. Mm-hmm. And the belt is the most kind of way out there area, right? So it's and the accents don't help. So for the first while, I was like, what the heck? Like you eventually figure it out. But for first while, I was like, what are they even saying? What's going on here?
Before we get too far into, I feel like we're so excited about discussing these episodes. We did want to talk a little bit about what our structure is moving forward because in starting this podcast, we wanted to, just for ourselves and for anyone else who might be interested, try to get through all of the episodes that are already out there before the season 4 premiere, which I believe is on December 13th. And they're dropping all of it at once on Amazon. So we're going to be watching two episodes every week and talking about two episodes per podcast episode. And we're going to try our best to keep the discussion in the first half of the episode spoiler free for people who have not watched the first three seasons before. So you'll have watched the episodes we're discussing most likely, but you know, we're going to try not to spoil anything about how these storylines ripple out. And then for the second half of the episode, we're going to talk about, you know, if you've seen through season three, how that changes your understanding of these episodes and the characters and the plot context. So, yeah. So hopefully that means that whatever kind of viewer you are, new or returning, you can get something out of this podcast. We're also hoping to do the occasional deep dive segment into lesser recognized parts of The Expanse storytelling team. So we're not sure what that's going to look like just yet, but I think there's a lot of really talented artists of all different kinds who work on this show, and using this podcast as a way to occasionally just talk about their work is a really cool opportunity, I think. And hopefully we're going to get some occasional guests who aren't the four of us to join in the conversation so we can get lots of different perspectives on this show because it brings so many perspectives to the table. And we have lots of smart and interesting friends and future friends who I think would really add something to this conversation. So if that sounds good to you, just keep tuning in.
And we're going to steer clear from the books. Not all of us have read them, and I'm afraid to read the books, honestly.
Me too.
I read a third of the first one, and then the show started up, and I was like, oh, I'm not going to put any effort into this. I'm just going to watch the show. So that's what I've done. I've got a friend who's read all the books, and he raves about them, but yeah. I've seen the show too.
I read the first one and wasn't in love with it, but I heard they get a lot better.
And I know that there are probably just enough differences between the storyline of the books and the TV shows that I probably have all kinds of fanish conniption fits trying to keep them all straight and decide which one I liked better.
Yeah, so, this is there's precedent for me with this where I remember, like, I love the Lord of the Rings movies so much. So I waited to read the books until after the installments came out because I didn't want to spoil the movies at all. And I stand by that.
Those are very different experiences of that story.
Yes, they are. I tried reading the third Return of the King after the movie and I was like, are they going to do anything? Is he going to just walk around a castle all day saying hello to people? Is this the book? Like, what the hell?
Now, I stan the books, but we are getting off topic. Let's talk about Dulcinea and the Big Empty, shall we? If it's been a while since you last watched it, let's give you some quick synopses of the two episodes. I'll go first with Dulcinea, which aired first on December 14th of 2015. That was almost 4 years ago. I'm old. So what you need to know about Dulcinea. Point first, Mars and Earth don't like each other, and they both look down on the belt, the civilization in the asteroid belt, the people who do all of the mining to help benefit all of the wealthier people on Earth and Mars. Yeah, so
working class Joes, basically, in
yep,
space.
Yep, this will become very important. point the second, a woman on a space freighter is hiding from some kind of attack. She finds unearthly glowing blue stuff that's eating people in the engine room. Roll opening credits. And then point the third. Later, a Belter detective is hired to investigate the woman's disappearance. The ice hauler Canterbury finds the space freighter's distress signal and sends a small team. The distress signal is a trap, and a mysterious stealth ship blows up the Canterbury. Roll credits. So that's a very basic synopsis of Dulcinea, but everything just sort of builds from there, doesn't it?
It does. The Big Empty aired originally on December 15th, 2015, which is interesting because it was the day after the first episode. So Sci-Fi was trying something different there. And it picks up right after the explosion of the Canterbury, and the shuttle that's holding some of its crew members, the Knight, is battered by debris from the explosion of their friends and coworkers. They only have 4 hours of oxygen left and no radio or transponder to ask for help. They work together. It's a little rocky apart, but they do. They work together. They figure it out to fix the antenna with wrenches and other tools and kicks. Holden kicks it, which was my favorite part of the episode. A ship finds them right before they run out of oxygen, but it turns out it's a Martian ship. And as they suspect that it was a Martian ship that blew up the Canterbury, that understandably worries them. So Holden makes an executive decision, as he is wont to do, and uploads or transmits a video. I said he uploads a video to his YouTube channel because that's what it felt like. He's just like, I'm live streaming, telling everyone basically what they suspect so far. And, you know, if no one hears from them again, it's because the Martians got them. So meanwhile, on Sirius Station, water resources are low in part because the Canterbury hasn't delivered its ice that they're waiting for, and bad news for the Belters, they're not going to, because that too was exploded. Our detective Miller is finding out more about Julie Mao, the girl he's looking for. She and her dad didn't get along. She had a racing ship. Miller and his partner Havelock catch some Belter kids for stealing water, but Miller lets them go, which kind of taps into the fact that he has these different allegiances as a Belter, but also as someone who's hired kind of like as a station cop. And finally, on Earth, Christian, new character, is called to UN headquarters, where she is admonished by Undersecretary Aaron Wright for torturing a suspected OPA operative. So she sends the operative to an off-world torture site because that's cool. But he commits suicide on the way. So she will never find out, at least from him, what he was doing with stolen stealth technology.
And that is the first two episodes of what will become an epic three-season ride. Bit of self-disclosure. I gave the DVD, Blu-ray. What am I? This is the 21st century. I gave the I gave the Blu-ray to my dad for his birthday recently because, you know, there it is. There's season one all in one package. He doesn't have to download it. There it is. And I told him that it's kind of one of the best science fiction series on right now. But how would you sell this show to somebody if you're trying to get them to watch and if you're trying to get them to get into these two episodes? You know, are these two episodes representative of what the show is going to be like in the future? And how would you sell it?
Yes and no. Yes, in that the intertwined, like it does, like even the opening tracking shot where they go through the entirety of like that one station more or less, does really sell that you're in this whole different world. It gets a lot done in about 5 minutes, and overwhelms you too. But it's also watching these characters not like, maybe this because I watched it once already, but then you go back and they're all like sort of at loggerheads with each other, and I was like, well, this is weird. And the weirdest thing of all is where Holden is with
spoiler.
Yeah, sorry.
I feel like I've heard Jen try to sell this show to lots of people. So how do you usually do it?
Well, one of the things I do try to sell when I sell people on it is I give them a caveat, which is I wasn't sold on this after the first two episodes. And even rewatching this, I kind of remembered some of the reasons why. I think it was probably maybe around episode 5 or 6 that it really stuck with me. I think they're just trying to introduce so many storylines at first that I definitely do tell people, like, it takes a little while for it to pay off, for you to care about these characters. If you're new and you're watching the show and you're just like, I don't know, keep watching.
It's a lot to take in.
There's parts of it that you can see of, like, there's so many small details of, like, oh, I mean, I think there's one part where, you know, Holden looks up and there's a rat on the spaceship. There's things about, you see these close-ups of, like, the air vent and why that's important, of like, the show is about resources, the show is about the politics, it's expanse. I keep saying expanse.
It is expansive. It's well named.
But I do think it takes a little while for the characters to kind of settle out.
There are basically three storylines going through these two episodes. You're following the crew of the Canterbury, and you're following Detective Miller on Ceres Station, and then there are these politicians on Earth. The links between them are kind of tenuous. We know that Julie Mao, the mystery woman at the beginning of episode 1, was on a ship called the Scopuli. Miller is given the task to find her. So those two storylines are kind of connected, but not really in that they don't really interact with each other. They're just what's happening over here and what's happening over there. And then there's the stuff happening on Earth. So it's not too much of a spoiler to say that this is setting up stuff for the future, but in the early going, Jen, it's like you said, you know, you have to have a little patience with it because you don't see how it all interrelates.
I think also, you know, I've heard the two men who co-write the books and who also are executive producers and are like active in writing the series talk about when they wrote these books, they didn't want it to just be like white men in space. And I think that the show isn't that. But if you're watching the first episode, because they're not really intercutting between these three storylines, like I think they wanted to stay and give a chunk of the storyline and then stay and do a chunk of the second and then stay and do a chunk of the third instead of like, it's already so confusing to try to keep track that you actually get like these two storylines for the first like third of the episode that are about like two white dudes in space. And I don't think that's representative of the show at all. And there's lots of other people who are part of those storylines. And you have the Julie Mao introduction, like teaser. But I think for me watching it the first time, like Jen and I saw this at an early screening at New York Comic Con. And I think, I can't remember if they showed both the first and the second episodes.
I don't think they showed the whole first episode. I think they maybe showed
maybe
like
just part of
20
it.
20 minutes.
Yeah. But I left that being like, it's beautiful. Like they're obviously doing a lot of things well. But I was like, is this just like, not knowing the books well, is this just like cops in space or like detective in space? And I feel like there's so many detectives on TV that I was like, really, this is what we're doing? So that is not what the show is about at all. But rewatching these episodes, or especially the first episode, I remembered that reaction and kind of felt the same way rewatching it.
Can I just jump in and say that I don't mind Thomas Jane in this show, but he does what every other detective on a TV show does, which is like be the sort of mumbly, quiet type who's all kind of grim. And it's just like, you know, the same old detective thing that you've seen a million times over. And I'm like, oh, this is what we're doing in space? Okay, all right. So that at first dragged me down a bit, because he gets better in later seasons when he's doing something else that I'm not going to go into. But for this whole first season, I'm like, enough of the detective shtick, okay? Like, everything else here is cool.
But the hat.
Yeah, the hat's great. And there's other bits and pieces that, and the stuff that goes on around him. But it's just that whole male archetype just gets on my nerves, so.
Any laws against beating up suspects?
No laws in series, just cops.
Yeah, I think even Alex's introduction, I was like, oh, okay, he's like the like laid back pilot. We've seen that so many times. But I think that is like, they're establishing these kind of tropes and they don't, it expands out from there. But when I first watched it, I didn't have the faith in the show.
Well, why would you?
To know that it was gonna, there's so many, you know, maybe not so many of these things, but there's so much television.
One of the things I like about episode one, Dulcinea, is they do a lot of good work on introducing lots and lots of characters on the Canterbury that I was positive were going to have a lot to do with the series going forward. And whoops, they're not just necessarily cardboard cutout. They all of the characters that are introduced on the Canterbury who don't get on the night shuttle, they could have been kind of interesting. I was taken by surprise that they'd done so much work on them and just snuffed them out right at the end of the first episode.
It does make it feel, though, that like you've dropped into something that's been ongoing for a while.
And I would say that's something that the show does so well going forward. There are so many characters that are in the show for a couple episodes or one episode that feel so realized and hint at so much happening that
who are murdered.
Yeah, you're like, oh, wow, this is a new interesting new character. And then something terrible happens.
And
to
there
them.
Are enough characters that are introduced in that same way who become very important to the show that you aren't necessarily. Yeah. Like if you haven't read the books, you don't necessarily know which ones are which. Yeah, which has created a sense of like stakes and suspense that a lot of shows are not good at.
What about the look of the show and the production values of this thing?
I can't believe that it gets made for how little it got made for. Like, because it's a sci-fi show, they couldn't spend that much money. But those effects are great. Like, they're fantastic.
Yeah.
Especially in space.
It's
like
so pretty.
The space stuff is just, anytime you see a ship fly around, you're like, that looks way better than it has any right to.
The flip and burn sequence, I just wrote that when I was taking notes. I just wrote it in big letters. I was like, it's so pretty. It's so cool.
It's a little too monochrome for my liking, the general look of the show. And maybe that shifts up a bit later on. But as stands in season one, it's very gray and blue and gray and blue and blue and gray.
Yeah. I want to make one last point about Dulcinea and then turn it over to the rest of you. And then we can move on to the big empty is... Our top billing actors here, Thomas Jane and Stephen Strait as Detective Miller and as Jim Holden, they both have something in common in that Detective Miller's kind of on the take and Holden's kind of unambitious and rebellious and resists getting a promotion and stuff like that. And throughout the episode, both of them have like these moments of crisis of conscience where Miller took a bribe to avoid having to investigate whether some air filters were being cleaned. And then he saw that kids were suffering as a result of that, and he did something about that. And Holden wanted to avoid responding to the distress signal and then couldn't sleep and listens to the distress signal. Nah, I've got to do the right thing. A couple of characters that sort of resist doing the right thing and then wind up doing the right thing. And I thought that parallel was interesting.
Agreed.
Yeah, I like that. That's really that. Like, now that you're saying that, that seems so obvious, but it was definitely not something.
Yeah, same here. I didn't pick up on it at first either.
About. Yeah.
Anything else about Dulcinea, or shall we move on to The Big Empty? A very different kind of show because it's sort of a bottle show.
Which you'd expect after all the effects they spent money on the first one.
I mean, I have so much I could say about that first episode, but I liked the second episode. I like this second episode a lot more. So
I have to make one very trivial point about Dulcinea, and that is when James Holden gets out of bed, I'm like, this is Low Gravity. Are you going to the gym all the time? Like, how does this, how is that possible?
Important question.
Well, he did have a Peloton in his, cabin there.
Like, that is, I think he's never shirtless again. So he's just like, okay, this is my one time and then we're done. Milkshakes for the rest of the day.
There's so many, there are so many elements of the first episode. I did look up, like, was this filmed as a pilot and then, sold? Or was, I think it was actually like they got a 10 episode order. Cause there are elements of the first episode that feel like have that pilot-y thing of like, we're trying to sell this to a network. It's not only trying to tell the story, but there's this also needs to be some sort of like commercial for the show.
True.
And I don't think that actually is what happened, but I feel like there are some elements like that. And I feel like just having like shirtless Holden or like introducing him in like a zero gravity sex scene. I don't know. I guess I was trying to sell it to the viewer. There's like things that don't necessarily feel representative of the show moving forward.
Yeah, you barely see any of that.
Or like indulgent. They feel indulgent, I guess. A lot of stuff actually to do with Holden's character in general. Jen and I were talking about this before we started recording. He feels less like Holden in this first episode than like most of the other characters feel like themselves moving forward. Like Naomi, Amos, like they just feel exactly like they are forever. You know, obviously they change and grow as characters.
They feel like the characters that they will be throughout the next three seasons.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which in some ways is like maybe a choice on someone's part that, you know, Holden goes through that makes this decision that results in the death of his girlfriend, his crewmates, you know, and he is like, oh, maybe I can't continue being as sarcastic and shirking responsibility as I have for whatever the 5 years he's been on the ship or whatever. But
that is one heck of a wake up call.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
I do like this subversion of the gender dynamics in their relationship where she's like, I mean, I was going to leave soon. Like, this is just casual. And he's like, but I thought we were going to, like, hang out some more. Like, I don't know. It's usually the opposite where it's the girl who's, like, portrayed as being more interested in, like, continuing a relationship or things beyond just, like, sex or whatever. But, yeah, I don't know. That kind of surprised me in an episode that I do think, like, a lot of the main male characters fall into some, like, kind of lazy, to me, like, stereotypes that – they don't moving forward as often.
Well, let's keep going. Let's talk about the big empty. So the Canterbury crew is gone. So they're down to five and they're in this one shuttle and it's been beaten the hell up. And it becomes one of these, we're trapped in an elevator stories. How are we going to survive kinds of things? And that's a kind of crucible for characters and trauma and stress trying to get through the situation.
Yeah, and finding out, you know, we all like to imagine we'd be like the brave one or the kind one or whatever in those situations. And it is, you know, interesting talking about like the nihilism of something like Game of Thrones. And I think like we didn't explicitly say it, but in contrast to there is like a hope and optimism to this show, while it's still like very, you know, realistic or pragmatic about the realities of living in space, I guess, or living in the world. And I feel like already in this second episode, you're kind of seeing that really beautiful balance of those elements. And
we start to get to know these characters a bit. For example, we didn't see a whole lot of Amos in the first episode. In this episode, he and Holden are outside trying to repair the antenna. And Amos tells Holden that, you know,
you must think I'm pretty stupid, don't you? I mean, you're right. I can take a core part, put it back together with my eyes closed. But ask me whether or not I should rip your helmet off and kick you off this bucket. And I can't give you a reason why I should. Or shouldn't. Except Naomi wouldn't like it. Could you pass me the drill?
in about 30 seconds, you get a very good sense of who this character is, and he's not entirely right.
I think part of it is he's had such, like, trauma from, and I've read, this is like a spoiler for the short story about him, but he's had such intense trauma, his ability to, like, connect to his emotions, yeah, I think, read is. The stories. So that's why, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's such an interesting character.
We get to know Naomi a little bit better. Amos says, as far as he's concerned, she's the captain. She's Same. Awesome. She's just awesome.
She is pretty awesome. Even later when things happen that I don't entirely approve of, she's still pretty awesome.
Yeah. And this is going back a little bit, but I do think it's interesting in the first episode. I think it's in the first episode. Holden chooses to tell Naomi that he was the one who logged the distress call. I thought that moment of vulnerability was so interesting and actually indicative of, like, his character and how she reacts, just being like, why would you tell me that? Like, he, in some ways, he has, like, the privilege to, I don't know, like, both he and Miller, to a certain extent, have, like, the privilege to waffle about, like, where their morality lies. And I think someone like Naomi just doesn't in the same way. And therefore, I don't know, she's just so much more certain and exact with her emotions and actions and getting things done that need to be done.
Any other highlights about those characters? I don't like Shad. I don't like Shad very much, the medic. I just don't. And yet he does turn around and he does come to Alex's rescue and is almost heroic in that. Well, no, he is heroic. Come on. I'll give him some credit.
I think there's a, you know, he's freaking out and then Holden kind of is like, you're in shock. And I don't think there's enough of him outside of, like, he goes from being in shock to saving Alex, and there's not much else to figure out who this guy is, really.
Yeah, because those are two very different characterizations. Yeah. Even though, like, Holden does give him something.
Yeah. He gives him some, but at the same time, you're like,
who is this person?
Who is this person?
Yeah.
The Miller investigation segment, you know, it's just there. The main function of this story is the main piece of this story is we're trapped on a ship, and how are we going to get out?
It does remind me of, like, a Firefly episode.
Oh, I don't know if you guys watched Firefly.
There's, like, Out of Gas, which is, like, in a great episode and has all these flashbacks to how they first met, but. Yeah, there's elements of this episode that really remind me of Firefly.
Including a very similar title, you know, The Big Empty, Out of Gas.
Interesting.
Maybe they're fans. Who knows?
So how about this political drama on Earth that we had in both of these two episodes? And Christian Avarsarala? Tell us about Christian.
She's just a hard ass. That's what I love about her. Like, she's doing stuff that I don't approve of politically, but I approve of her doing it politically because she just doesn't take any crap from anybody. That's what I think is great. Plus, that voice would normally scare me, but because she's so wonderfully sweary, it somehow works. I'm not sure why.
Yeah, I remember the first time watching these episodes, I was like, I wasn't sure if she was an antagonist or not. And I think that actually, for all these characters, they don't really fall very clearly into easy categories, but it is very cool that she's introduced as, like, she's an older woman of color. She's introduced as, like, a grandmother in some way. And she just is so much more than that. That's one of so many identities and, like, not really even the one that the show is very interested in. And she just feels like no other character I've ever seen on television before. And immediately, she was one of the characters that I was like, I want to find out more about her.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. I was, you know, she is basically introduced torturing a belter in Earth normal gravity. And that was kind of gruesome.
True.
Yeah, for sure.
But it's Christian, so I'll allow it.
Yeah, more on that when we talk about spoilers. But in the early going with these two episodes, you know, the Earth politics just seems like a weird diversion. It's tonally different. It's visually different. You know, I'm waiting for the threads to connect. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, for me, I don't know. It's so hard to remember because, like, it is having that context of knowing where these storylines are going and how they relate. And they do have that moment where you see, you know, Christian on the news on Sirius Station. But yeah, the connections are very tenuous at this point. But like I said before, I think like I always was fascinated in this storyline because it her character really does feel so different from, you know, like in comparison, especially at this point, to like Miller and Holden's characters, who feel very similar to characters I've seen before, not just in this genre, but also in the genre. And yeah, she just felt totally new. So I think I was willing to let the lack of maybe like plot motivation or reason for being here slide a lot more than I would have if that was like there was a detective story on Earth. You know, that would have been like, nope, don't care.
One thing I find interesting from a world building standpoint is that they show that Earth is united, and that from what I can tell, there's racial harmony, and some of the problems that we've had are gone. At least, but we're still kind of screwed because Mars hates us and they're better at a lot of stuff than we are. So it was just interesting that, yes, you solved these problems. Here's a batch of new ones.
There is this moment in the second episode, too, where Christian has the line, the Cold War is over. This is something new. And I think at this point where you're grasping so much to try to understand like the larger context and how these things fit together, that she is a useful, at least in that moment. Just kind of like narrator or big picture person or voice in that moment that was helpful for me.
Yeah, she's sort of grounding some of that information that was given to us just in an opening text crawl on episode one about this is, you know, Mars, Earth, the belt, they don't get along.
Which totally felt out of place, by the way, that text thing.
Yeah, because all these other characters have so much less information than she does. Most people in this universe have less information than she does. So, she's like the only example of someone who has that kind of power. And it is interesting that she's an outlier in that way. And because of that is able to like give us some information that other characters just wouldn't have any access to.
Well, on some level it makes sense that she's the person delivering what in some ways is like the geopolitical techno babble, because she probably does that legitimately as a character.
Yeah,
you know, she does have the viewpoint of what is happening throughout the system as much as she can as a politician. You know,
it doesn't feel like forced exposition in a way that when other characters maybe
stuck in a shuttlecraft, for instance.
Exactly.
Like, oh, I wonder how the Cold War is going now.
Yeah.
Oh, and oxygen.
Also, we only have 5 minutes left of oxygen.
Right. And so that episode wraps up with laser gun sights pointing at all five of our hardy survivors, and we don't know how well they'll survive. You know, if you're watching this for the first time, maybe they'll all get killed off in the first minutes of the next episode, and this whole series will focus on an entirely different cast of characters.
It could happen.
It could happen. But that will be in the episodes that we look at next time, which will be Remember the Cant and CQB. Now, we're going to start talking about these episodes in the broader context of the whole expanse. So if you want to jump off now, before we spoil you for all kinds of stuff, now's your opportunity. Just want to let you know that you can find us on Twitter at Legit Salvage. Oh, we never did tell you why this podcast has its name. A Legitimate Salvage. There, slight spoiler here, there will be a ship that certain characters are going to find. And they will be accused over the next 3 years of the show of having stolen the ship. And they will say, no, it's a legitimate salvage. And that is why we call this thing. Anyway, we're on Twitter at Legit Salvage. And you can find our episodes wherever you find your podcasts. And we are hosted at The Incomparable Network, with thanks to Jason Snell for giving this new podcast a home. Shall we actually start talking about everything that we know that works into these two episodes?
Yes.
That's good to me.
There were a lot of moments where I was like, I don't remember. I know this is important, but I don't actually remember the context of why it's important. Yeah.
All right. Spoiler time. So the first thing that I wanted to mention is the pre-credit sequence in episode one is so effing important, and for a while, until we get into the proto-molecule stuff, it just, you almost forget about it. But for these two episodes are serious hard SF with serious physics and all this other stuff. But we have blue stuff eating people. And by the end of the series, that blue stuff eating people is going to be responsible for like hyperspace gates throughout the universe.
That's pretty cool when you just summarize it like that.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask you all, you know, what you thought about the pacing of it, because it's like it starts off as one show and becomes totally different by the time we get to the end of season three.
It takes its own sweet time getting there, though. I think like season two is like the proto-molecule screwing things up and you have no idea what, and you still basically don't know what the hell it is by the end of the second season. So I think they play that pretty well, and they wait till more or less the end of this season to really get into it. Which I kind of liked. Like, they do stretch it as far as it needs to go. It felt right at the end of season three to have them expand past, there I go doing it, first time, take a drink, past where they were going.
Yeah, I don't think the protomolecule where it's at now, there's never been a moment where I'm like, oh, this is too much from where it started. Like, it's always felt organic to me. It is kind of interesting to look back and be like, I know you're saying this blue stuff is eating people, but it feels so understated when you get to what is it, Arrow Station? Yeah, by the end of the season, it's like that is, there's blue everywhere, it's eating things, it's crawling up the, you know, and this just still felt so small.
It's just easing you into this thing. I mean
it ramps up the WTF, but it does it very well.
You know, I'm avoiding the books, so I think they're like six books behind where the novels are.
Something like that, yeah.
So I don't know where this thing is going, but inter-systems travel through those ring gates is just, if they had done it too quickly, it would have been too hard to swallow for sure.
That's true. Yeah, I'm glad they waited this long, and it was an okay place to end it when Sci-Fi canceled it, which is dumb, but anyway.
And there is that point when Holden is hallucinating in season four, or maybe he's not hallucinating.
Or
he's
season
three, or communicating with the protomolecule, whatever we want to call that. And he has that conversation with Amos, and Amos is just like, all of this weird stuff has happened. Like, I like that the space has become normal and home to so many of these characters, and we're watching them as space. They discover how weird space can become.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what we were talking about before with Christian and the fact that she is able, because of who she is as a character, to deliver this information about, like, the socio-political context of where the, you know, solar system is at now. The moving forward with the protomolecule, the show does that really well in terms of, it's not like you have like Naomi or who, like Holden, suddenly has all this information about the protomolecule that they just figured out because, like, oh, they're a secret scientist or just have this knowledge. Like, they bring in characters and, like, settings that make sense to, like, explain those parts of it. So that just so many shows, the plot drives the character. And in the show, they are able to expand the plot in really amazing ways, and the plot is so important, but they bring in characters to do that in a really cool way.
And the characters do push the plot. It is them sort of reacting to the circumstances that they're in and making decisions along the way. You mentioned Christian. Like I mentioned before the spoiler break, you know, when we meet her, she's torturing a belter.
I'm sorry the gravity of a real planet hurts, but it's appropriate. You wish to hurt Earth. The Earth that is now crushing your weak belter lungs and your fragile belter bones. All you have to do to make it stop is talk.
She doesn't do that much awful stuff over the course of three seasons, and I was wondering if that was really a misstep for introducing the character.
I mean, you kind of expect that in a pilot, though, or second show. Like, you just kind of take it as read that, okay, fine. This is where they thought they were going, and they didn't end up going there. You know, so that doesn't bug me as much, just because I'm used to the way TV works, and that is a perfect example of how it works. As they try a thing, it doesn't work. This is the first part of the season, so they can get away with just taking a hard right turn somewhere else. It's not even a hard right turn. It's more of a soft right? Her turn with her.
I feel like it doesn't feel necessarily out of character for her to me in relation to like the cruelty of it. It more so feels out of character in the fact that it's not very effective. And like, I feel like she would have a better way of getting information. Like torture, how effective is it? And I feel like Christian would know that. And she'd have like, I don't know, a better way of figuring things out.
Yeah, she turns into more of a manipulator and a schemer. And that's not the Christian that we see in the first episode. That's for sure.
It's more fun to watch too, manipulating, scheming. Mm-hmm. Just torture gets old pretty quick. So
I do I found one of the scenes I thought that was the most interesting, knowing what we know now, is the conversations between her and Aaron Wright. And I didn't realize he was introduced so early.
No, I didn't either, actually.
Yeah.
And he seems like such a nothing burger in that second episode.
Yeah. Yeah. He gets like his name on the thing, which I was like, have they introduced other characters like this? Because I kind of like it. Like they actually like visually have his name.
Secretary.
Yeah. Which I guess makes it seem like he might be somewhat important, but there's so many characters you're just like, whatever. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that fact that he is the voice of like reason or empathy, or I don't know. You don't know where that is necessarily coming from. I guess he just doesn't want to break the rules. He's like the rule follower.
You'd think.
But he's the one who's until later. You can't torture this guy. Although I guess he's just like, torture him at our offsite facility.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Now, talk about a character that you love to hate. that is a character who starts, who seems to be nothing, turns out to be the mastermind behind the whole bleeding conspiracy. But in the middle, there's this pivot turn where it almost seems like he's going to turn and do the right thing.
Mm.
I hate that character with a passion.
Yeah, he's bad.
I can't think of another villain character in major SF that I just I really want to hiss the villain here.
What about Julie's dad? Julie's dad is he as bad? He's bad. He's pretty damn bad.
I know, because he's like hangs out with kids. But I guess like Aaron Wright, one of his like moments is with his son too, and you're just like, what is?
So there's bits and pieces where they have added some dimensionality, both these guys, but they're still scumbags.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's scarier when you have that dimensionality and you can see how they care about people and have the capacity for empathy and then make that choice. I think that's way scarier than someone who's just like a sociopath.
Particularly his own daughter, where he's like, then they have a whole bunch of flashback stuff in series 3, I think, which sort of fleshes things out. But at the same time, you still let that happen to her. So, okay.
Yeah.
One of you had an interesting question in our show notes document. Should Naomi have been captain all along?
I mean, she probably would have been just as good at it.
She might as well have been the captain in episode 2 in The Big Empty. Amos would have followed her to the ends of the earth.
Take everything apart. Be fast and be careful. We're inside a balloon with a pin here. If it has a battery, a power pack, any charge capability, it goes into a pile. I'm sorry, does anyone need a backup first?
You know, is Stephen Strait as James Holden sort of, is he sort of lodged into a great man character when Naomi was there all along?
I mean, a little bit, because like that's the one thing I don't really buy is why they just accept him as the captain. Like, once he's in there, he's not bad as a captain, but why they just go, yeah, okay, fine. Unless they explained it and I forgot.
Yeah, because there's definitely a point where Amos is just like, rank doesn't mean anything now, right? Yeah, like, there's only five of us left.
And he's like, and I listen to Naomi, so that's at least one of us or two of us who are Team Naomi.
And I guess maybe it makes sense, but they don't even really hold on to that structure, because Naomi really is the captain in this episode.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, when she shuts down the engine or whatever.
And she also just is like, okay, you work on this transponder, you... She's very decisive in a way that Holden is not. Mm-hmm.
And she's good at motivating them,
too. Holden is decisive, but only for his own actions, not other people's actions.
Yeah. I think this is one of the things that kind of annoys me about... I understand why they get so upset when Naomi gives the protomolecule to the OPA, but I also feel like Holden makes a lot of unilateral decisions like that. and they forgive him relatively quickly because he's like the captain. And it is a big decision, mm-hmm. but I don't know. I feel like it's kind of a double standard.
If I could pull out my Doctor Who fandom for a moment, there's a lesson here for the current Doctor Who production team when it comes to what to do with a supremely capable and competent female character, is not to just rely on that character's competence as being the whole thing for that character, which is what I think has happened to the Yaz character in Doctor Who. Give that character some conflicts. Give that character some decisions to make. And I think Naomi is the most inherently competent and capable character on The Expanse, at least with this core team of four. Sorry, Shad, you're not going to be around much longer. But because Naomi has decisions to make, she does. There's not this glass jar that falls around her and says, you're the smart engineer. No, she's far more than that. Give those characters something to do, and they won't steer you wrong in the storytelling.
Yeah. Jen was also talking about
flat team structure
to make another Doctor Who reference.
Which I feel like at times, as we get into the Rossi, like, they do feel like they have a much more flat team structure. And then at other times, everyone is like, but Holden is the captain.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that isn't... at what point, when you have such a small crew, is it so much about the interpersonal relationships? Are you following some sort of hierarchy?
Right. Mm-hmm. I think it's, for the most part, they start observing hierarchy when other people are in the room, other people on the show, and they're interacting with other characters that are new to the Rocinante or where they're off somewhere, and they show loyalty to Holden then, but it's a little flatter and a little looser when they're all sort of arguing with each other about what to do.
Absolutely.
I love this show.
It's so good, and it gets so much better.
It does. And I'll tell you what I think is a perfect example of how this show gets better. Episode 2, there are some water thieves on Ceres, and one of them's this guy named Diogo. And he's a jerk. And just about every time that we see him, except the time when he's floating marooned in space by his uncle, just about every other time we see him, he's a smug jerk, and then he's an ambitious jerk. And I saw him in this episode, and I thought to myself, self, in just over 2.5 seasons, you're going to be smiling very big on the inside because this guy's going to get an elevator dropped on.
And they just do it out of nowhere, too. It's just done. He's dead.
Yeah.
But he's like one of the few people who has no character development. He's just this annoying, grinning idiot who's just, he's just like this, the boisterous 16-year-old boy you don't want to talk to after 10 minutes. But he's always like that.
And he's like weirdly shows up in a lot of different places in a way that the show doesn't usually do. Like, oh, well, look who it is. It's Diogo.
It's Poochie.
Diogo again.
Yeah, he basically is Poochie.
When he shows up in the third season, I was just like, you've got to be kidding me.
But that does happen in real life sometimes. And you're just like, why is this person here? Like,
I'm not a huge fan of Miller, but when Miller had to drag him around, I was like, oh, Miller, you don't deserve this. Come on.
Oh, goodness. Nothing against the actor. The actor is doing exactly what the character is asked to do. But boom.
Do we want to talk about Miller's partner at all?
Liz. Havelock.
Because I do feel like he's someone that I'm like... I remember really liking him the first time, even though, and like I feel like they commit to him more than they do a lot of characters who aren't around that long. But yeah, watching it this time, I'm kind of just like, I'm not really going to waste any energy on caring about you.
Can I say my biggest peeve about Miller?
Absolutely.
Is that he's just a way too, like, he's way too over the top obsessed with Julia Mao. It's uncomfortable, frankly.
I know.
Like, here, it just reminds me of guys who go to Thailand to marry somebody. You know, it's just like, this is some shirt tugging here, Miller. Could you just tone it down a little bit?
That is definitely one of the things that I'm going to be watching for in this rewatch, is where does that attachment come from? Is it ever adequately developed, or does it just... is it just an obsession that comes out of nowhere?
He's totally the kind of character who would. You know what I mean? It's another reason it's so annoying.
Like, he has like a savior complex. And there's this beautiful woman who he doesn't actually know, but he decides that he knows. Because I also think there's like the moment in this episode, in the second episode, where he's like the way he interacts with his coworker, who's also, I guess, his love interest.
I think they have some sort of history.
Yeah. I just feel like he's really creepy to her, and that like bar scene too, or just like annoying, like, and inappropriate. And like, he says something to her like, I need a woman's intuition, and, you know, on this case. And I don't know. I feel like that is a pattern of like how he seems to treat women.
But he eventually gets his atoms scattered, so meh.
Yeah. And he did find, he did seem to, in both of these episodes, if there were like children coughing, there were, there was something like that, there were always young girls. And I wonder if that was just sort of like trying to set up this father feeling or something creepier orientation toward Julie Mao. I'm not sure. Like I said, we'll be watching.
Yeah. I feel like I don't know if the show is aware of it. Or is like views it in that way.
Yeah, I don't. I get the feeling
I am curious too to like, yeah, for me, that's like one of the missteps that the show seems to make. But maybe watching it this time, because I don't think it's necessarily a misstep to have that be a storyline, but to have it be a storyline and not see it as creepy, I think is a misstep. Yeah.
Stay tuned. Any other final thoughts about The Expanse and the first two episodes thereof and how they fit into The Expanse of The Expanse? How many times can I say that word?
Keep watching.
Yep.
Because it gets really, really good.
And on that note, we will be back in a week's time again for Remember the Cant and CQB. And we appreciate you tuning in for this first episode of A Legitimate Salvage. For Jen, Katie, and Warren, this is Chip, and we will see you next week.